Welcome to episode 13 of the Brilliant Podcast. I am your host Bellamy, joined by co-host Aragorn.
We live in a world where most stories are just variants of the same story. Good beats evil, cowboys and Indians, prophets and moss. This story has been told 1,000,000,000 times, and the ubiquity of it is what I would call a great tragedy. A tragedy because of the consequences it has on our imagination and our capacity to be together. The brilliant attempts to tell stories about the brilliant ones, the ones who live human-sized lives that seem larger than life. The ones who dream beyond recognition. The ones who are satisfied not answering every question the critics ask, and just living with the contradictions, living in the silence. This is an attempt to tell different kinds of stories, ones with complex moral plays, ones that aren't so clearly stories, and ones that are of small human size. Our motivation to tell these tales is a desire to see a proliferation of different stories, and not just the simple morality plays of popular culture or the inverted, but otherwise identical, stories of the radical milieu.
Okay, so this week we want to talk about a few things, some responses to the events in Paris, and a response to a long and thoughtful email from a listener who was engaging with us in a critical sort of way. And I think we are going to start, though, with the Anarchist News topic of the week, entitled Personal History, Doing and Being. And just to summarize this topic, the questions being posed are, how did you become an anarchist? When did it occur to you that this label makes sense? And what has been the most interesting consequence of claiming yourself as this thing?
My own personal story, because it was a while ago, it was from a time where this question wasn't quite so crystal clear. Like, I think nowadays, in the context of us talking about a scene, people are talking about sort of finding a new group of friends at the same time that they're talking about a politic, or they're talking about their politics in the context of some sort of activist history. And so, for me, in the late 80s, early 90s, while I officially started calling myself an anarchist around 1990, I didn't really, I wasn't part of a thing until probably 92, 93. And that was because I ended up working at this place that was a collectively run anarchist cafe called the Che Cafe. But prior to that, and sort of in solitude, I had come to the self-determination that I was an anarchist more or less in the middle of a political conversation with a person I don't even remember now. We were talking about sort of what kind of reforms we would like medical care or, sort of socialist type. And it might have been in the context of that silly movie, SLC Punk.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, that might have been later. But there was a sort of even in the late 80s, people were talking about socialized medicine and how much better people have it in Scandinavia and whatnot. And what I said at the time was that socialized medicine is impossible to get in the context of the U.S. Like, it'll never happen. And so they got me thinking that on the question that if you're going to actually express a desire for something, the possibility of that thing ever happening is sort of, irrelevant. So really what I determined was sort of if you're going to do real politique, meaning you're going to make brutal compromises and you're going to do whatever it takes to sort of win from the position of your political perspective, then it makes sense to be a socialist or a Democrat or a Republican. But if you're not willing to basically kill people for your personal value system, then perhaps you should not be tied down to labels that are outrageous. So again, this is the late 80s, so I was young and naive at that point. But mm-hmm. but that's
and
when
just,
I...
How old were you, just so people can make sense
of it? Yeah, about 20. Uh-huh. And so that was when I declared myself an anarchist. And what I basically said was that if the things that you all are talking about in the context of politics are impossible to get, I might as well declare myself for the things I actually desire that are perhaps the most impossible things to get, but they're no more impossible than the things that you all are desiring. They're just sort of more upfront about it. Anyway, so that was my transition, and that was in 1990, and you know, my activist orientation at that time was around anti-racist stuff, and then I joined this collectively run restaurant, and that's really what taught me about the scene and the fact that there are all these books and all this stuff. So really prior to that, it was a thought exercise. Anyways, that's my story.
Yeah, and I was talking to you just before we started recording, saying that I feel like I've, to some extent, told bits of this story, so I'm going to try to do it efficiently without too much redundancy. And for me, growing up as a kind of lower middle class kid in suburban Ohio, it was not in the least a social phenomenon at all for me. It was really, it felt at first like a philosophical phenomenon, and then later, as I started to come to grips with it in retrospect, a lot of it was a familial phenomenon. And so both my parents were second generation Americans, with my father's side having immigrated from Ireland, my mother's from Germany, and my father came from a, you know, line of alcoholic, physically abusive patriarchs, and that was the way that he operated in my family. And my mother, on the other hand, was this sort of neurotic, hyper-nurturing person, which in retrospect, what I see is a sort of ultra-heterosexuality, extreme gender roles. And then at the same time, my brother, who was older, was constantly getting into legal trouble for petty crime. And so my experience at home was of this kind of lack of communication, abusive environment, and a sort of constant police presence. My brother was regularly getting arrested. The police came to my house a lot. The police came to my house for domestic violence reasons. And at that time growing up, I sort of, the way I made sense of it was that, you know, something was wrong with these people who were around me, and I couldn't couch it in any kind of sociocultural understanding or any understanding of these larger structures. And then later, when I left home to go to college, is where I start to really get distance and perspective on the situation. And at the same time, I was being introduced through some people around me to these, you know, unusual philosophical ideas, ones that were not explicitly political, but that were really changing the way I was looking at things. And that led me more and more into wanting to understand the world around me through reading and engaging with ideas. And I eventually encountered anarchist literature, and then retrospectively started to try to put together, well, you know, why were these sorts of things happening to my family? And I ended up understanding bit by bit these phenomena like patriarchy and the police state, and realizing that, you know, even though I was a really, by so many measures, a really privileged person, these sorts of things were really still affecting my life. And around the same time, I became familiar with and attracted to ideas of permaculture, and then decided that these were things that I wanted to live out.
Yeah, the topic of the week, as it turns out, I didn't. As it turns out, that this is a fantastic topic of the week. It's been really interesting to see how many people responded and what they said. And it continues to be true that a lot of people who are active in the anarchist space today came in through CrimeThink. Mm-hmm. And seeing people sort of be upfront about that and talk about that has been really sort of exciting and interesting to me. Just today, somebody named Crudo, who, of course, we know really well because they're in the Bay Area, wrote a really nice, very personal, long entry on the topic. And I like these sort of things. It's really nice to sort of hear people's stories. And so, yeah. Next up, we're going to talk about the Paris events for, I mean, sort of France's 9/11. Coordinated attack by multiple sort of units of allegedly IS. Hmm. They bombed and shot their way to around 150 deaths in the streets of Paris. And so obviously some French comrades of different sorts have sort of made their statements. And we're going to talk a little bit about this statement called The Real War. It's sort of one of the most complex or deep of the responses, but many of them have been good. And I mostly note this one because it was translated by Robert Hurley, who also translated The Theory of Bloom that we published about 4 years ago, and that, of course, came out like 15 years ago, or nearly 15 years ago. And so, so because Robert has very good taste, and I sort of trust his judgment, this has definitely been the article that's popped for me. And so, yeah, what were your initial thoughts on it?
Well, do you want to read a bit of it to start off? So just some sections that we selected that spoke to us. The whole piece is rather long, so I don't want to read the entirety. But here's a bit. And it needs to be said, all this business about freedom that's been tweeted back and forth and hashed over in articles and speeches for the past 3 days doesn't ring at all true. Moreover, because the freedom that one has on the sexual, professional, cultural, or simply social market is so tightly structured by the ferocious competition that prevails there, that this freedom could just as well be called terrible servitude instead. Lastly, because the freedom of I do what I like with my hair, with my ass, with my dick, with my tongue, etc., looks quite pathetic, really, in the sober light of the morning after. The bourgeois adage, which, from the Middle Ages to Michelet, endlessly proclaimed that city air is liberating, lapsed into uselessness like just about everything else the bourgeoisie invented. Work won't set you free anymore either, and hasn't for a very long time. So on the contrary, the air of the metropolis makes you lonely, connected, depressed, miserable, self-centered, sociable, competitive, hard, opportunistic, fuckable, or fucked. Whatever, but not free.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a nice... a nice drop-in when you're talking about something like terrorism, which, you know, terrorism is, at this point, is such a meaningless term. You know, really, we're talking about what's the social space in the metropole? What are the consequences of civilization? Mm-hmm. You know, to turn this in a more generic light, like they've totally named it, and they've named it in a way that I think is really nice.
Yeah, I found it quite refreshing because, unlike some radical responses to the Paris events, which frame things entirely in terms of, well, this is what the pushback to colonialism looks like, mm-hmm. which of course is a really important dimension and analysis to have, but rather than framing it just in terms of here's the colonizer living the relatively free and privileged life and getting the pushback from those on whose backs they're allowed to live that life, this also is putting the shadow of doubt on that whole life that is being made possible by the exploited, that you know, maybe you just look like a bunch of neurotic caged animals that don't know what to do with themselves, and so the coolest thing you can think to do is, you know, go out and get drunk at night, and how terrible that this is being taken from you, right?
Yeah, for me it does go even a little further, because as much as I've talked about genocide in past issues, mm-hmm. and I have feelings about the topic of genocide, there's this thing called history,
familiar.
Well, I mean, like when you hear a person's personal story about how they've been impacted by history, you can be sympathetic, but when that story becomes sort of inscribed in the capital H history, it transforms into something else. It transforms into something that no longer for me feels of a size that I can understand it, and instead it becomes sort of talked about as an institutional thing. So I don't want to racialize this, but for instance, in the context of France, of course, France is not multicultural in the sense that the U.S. is.
Yeah,
there is a,
for sure.
Like, especially in France, like
French identity.
There's a French identity. Mm-hmm. There, you know, there's language requirements. There's even clothing requirements that is part of the French identity.
And much more homogeneous ethnic requirements than.
Right.
I mean, white identity in America is this mishmash, right? Whereas French identity is. Yeah.
No. For sure. And you know, by and large, the. Yeah. Anyways, and so for me, the when we talk about like an event like this in the context of history, we a lot of people try to wrap it in a causal bubble. You know, in other words, they try to say that because France did this, IS did this.
Right.
Rather than accept that on some fundamental level, this is an absurd thing that's happened. I mean, in the existentialist sense of the word, like this is a. We now live in this era where horrific acts happen. Mm-hmm. And so from an anti-Civ perspective here, we can say that absurd acts happen because civilization has been pressing on people for such a long time. And that's a sort of discernible thing. But I would sort of shy away from that and say that, the nature of the city, the nature of going out at night and enjoying yourself, part of the security conversation that's happening around this event is that perhaps that time is over. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there's no more celebrations on the streets, and so of course, you know, you hear in the back of your head all the conspiratorial thinking saying, you know, that all of this is, you know, part and parcel of statecraft, and perhaps this was even, you know, motivated by particular individuals or by conspiracies. But instead, all of these things are framing exercises. All of these things are basically like different worldviews clashing in the form of today's headlines. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess the thing that I just deeply don't understand out of all of this is, like, what were the actual motivations of the people who did the attack?
Sure.
They weren't revolutionary.
Sure.
Even if you're going to argue that they wanted to start a new IS chapter in France that you know, wages war on France in the same way that Syria and Iraq are under siege, mm-hmm. I can't possibly I don't get it.
Yeah, there are a few things in there I want to respond to. So one way that I've heard it being construed by more sort of progressive liberal analysts is to say, look, this is the same kind of trick that Osama bin Laden was trying to play, that ostensibly Osama bin Laden at some point in his recordings or his discourse with others, supposedly he made his motivation for 9/11 clear, saying, what I want to do is bait the U.S. into this massive imperialist venture that's going to bankrupt them and ruin their international reputation, and it's going to be, you know, one sort of way to, you know, drag the beast into the quagmire, and that ISIS is trying to do the same thing. What that doesn't tell you is, of course, what was going on personally for those people. It was interesting to see this person, the authors of this article, The Real War, were actually causing this kind of immediate pleasure for the people saying that it was great for them to feel that they were gunning down the, you know, the arrogant Western people in the midst of their debauchery.
That's fiction.
Of course.
Yeah.
But it tells you something about the way that we might... This article is trying to frame both camps as deeply religious and deeply committed to their own ideologies, and so it's a way that we might think that ideologues play off at each other.
Mm.
But I don't think anyone, no matter how possessed they are of an ideology, is really being motivated through and through to their core by it.
Yeah, for sure. I feel much more comfortable saying that we cannot possibly imagine
mm-hmm.
what was going on in their heads to, mm-hmm. to do this. Like in a suicide bomber situation, like, in other words, the coordination is the additional puzzle that I don't get. Like, we can understand the motivation of suicide. Like, you feel powerless in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You would like to take some action in the world.
Right.
And some sort
feel
of suicide thing.
In some last moment that
yeah,
you have
like,
agency.
Right. I mean, so pulling the pin, I can kind of wrap my mind around that. You know, I've been lucky enough to not be quite at that point, but, you mm-hmm. know, we've all at least intellectually contemplated suicide
mm-hmm.
for one reason or another. But the idea of a coordinated, like, it's coordinated absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the military might, I mean, we've now seen, you know, decades of examples of what the response is to these sorts of actions. You know, these the response is always more nationalism,
mm-hmm.
more reaction. It's never, in very few examples, is it anything that looks like a liberalization. There's a couple Scandinavian examples that are unusual
mm-hmm.
because they were treated like they were just lone wolves rather than a social condition. But, you know, France is basically, for the next 5 to 10 years, is going to be grappling with this homegrown terror,
mm-hmm.
and which, you know, of course, to use the silly terminology, I find it to be amazing.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you say that you were shying away from the anti-civ narrative, and I don't know that of course, one application of the anti-civ narrative is the one in which we have capital H history, right?
Yeah.
But I think you can also just in the sort of everyday, I mean, the social experience of atomization, the everyday experience of, you know, I have to make the compromise after compromise every day to just get through the day. To me, it actually shines a certain light of understanding on the fact that, you know, we have two very different...
What's happening outside? Sorry for the momentary interruption. We just had someone blowing their horn for no obvious reason.
Yeah. So you're saying it's a way to shine a light of understanding on the fact that you have this sort of collision of worlds. You have the people who live in France, who live under a, you know, a sort of social democracy, capitalist world where you could see it as perfectly normal to go out, spend a bunch of money on drinks, spend a bunch of money to get into a concert, dance around, and think all's well and good, and this is what life looks like. And then have, at the same time, people coming from this incredibly different place of understanding of saying, yeah, it feels good and right and appropriate to gun down these people. And it's a way of saying, or the understanding of civilization is a way of understanding how could these two different groups of people be living what are really weird lives and really weird systems of belief, come into conflict, and have seemingly mutual incomprehension. Well, to me, it's only through a story of what the civilizing process looks like that you would even end up at a situation like that.
I think that that's fair. The reason I hesitate from landing squarely on that sort of perception, it's too much a narrative in search of a solution,
mm-hmm.
and so for me the fact that there's this problem and the problem is civilization, but the problem is also much smaller than that. Like, the problem is also the difference between a bohemian or the bourgeoisie drinking their drinking their drinks, and basically a set of what feels like very, like mostly the stories I've heard have been very young, lost immigrants, mm-hmm. in this bohemian culture. There's something that feels psychological in there,
mm-hmm.
that I guess I would like to understand. Like I feel like there's something really interesting and really powerful in the. I guess if we were to talk about this in the 1930s, we'd be talking about what is it that makes someone become a Nazi,
mm-hmm.
right, join the Nazi Party, sure. Because this is the equivalent of joining the party, like doing an IS action of this caliber. And you know, in the 1930s, the Nazis were, you know, taking hikes in the forest, and so I'm sure that there's a series of steps in the context of the IS discourse that then leads you to consider taking violent action against the forces that oppress you. And that conversation and that conversion is very similar to what any revolutionary anarchist has to be thinking about too. If you're truly a revolutionary anarchist, you have to be thinking about what actions do new revolutionary anarchists take to become revolutionary anarchists that are willing to pick up a gun, to actually fight the demon rather than just accuse other people of not fighting the demon. And so there's the difference, the gap between that, the passivity of what we see online in the context of ideology and whatever, like, you know, this was a real thing. And by and large, we're experiencing middle-class people not doing real things at all. And there probably is this sort of a rage bank that's being filled up. And so that's sort of more the direction I have interest in, rather than just sort of saying, like, civilization did it, and perhaps throwing our hands up and saying, and civilization is big, enormous, and there's no way to fight it other than going camping a lot.
Mm-hmm. So just so I'm clear, you're saying the psychological aspect is what's the difference between the person who believes and comments online and the person who believes and picks up a gun?
Right, with perhaps, though, normally a post-situationist like myself would talk about this in the context of where's the ideology and where isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because both are examples of people performing ideological functions. And we normally sort of evaluate ideology in this blanket way that is sort of not full, that isn't honest. And, you know, the honesty of this moment is that there's a set of young people who just don't get, like, where there's just some gap. And perhaps I just can't identify that gap because it has so much to do with religion. And I just don't get the religion. I don't understand it at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas I do understand Christianity more. I've grown up around it, blah, 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 blah. So I guess for me, the gap or the fascinating aspect here is this cultural / psychological gap. And I just want to make a further point, which is, you know, I would love to see these sort of analyses come out of the American context. At a different point in the article, you didn't read, they actually make this point that is so French. They refer to something as being said by Arnault and Nicole. And when I saw the reference, I was like, who in the hell are these people? As it turns out, the sort of basic philosophical text that's used to introduce people to formal logic in the French context were written in the 17th century by Arnault and Nicole. The idea that, like, an essay about, you know, terrorism in the streets of Paris drops that sort of a reference just sort of speaks to the gap of how these conversations happen in the Anglophone world versus the Francophone world. And I just found it to be a fascinating, I mean, I had to look up the reference.
Yeah.
And I just find it to be a fascinating thing.
Sure. Do you want to close with how they close, or
as
you cap off this topic?
Oh.
So they finish off by saying, quote, "May last Friday's attacks, and those that are bound to follow, given the spiral which the governing authorities have deliberately set in motion, make us truer and less distracted, deeper and less hypocritical, more serious and more communist. For us, this is the real war, the one that, in the West, merits the risking of one's life. The war to have done with economy. But it is a war, let it be said, that's not pursued via spectacular massacres, however anti-economic they may be. The warfare, in our case, is essentially indirect. It is through lived communism that the terrain of economy will be diminished, which doesn't rule out bold actions when they're appropriate to the situation. More clearly than ever, the construction of a sensitive communism is the only thing capable of punching through the historical nightmare from which we're trying to wake up.
I mean, it's a beautiful sentiment. I mean, obviously this comes from the Apolista type of a perspective, but so it's a beautiful perspective that basically says that we're creating sort of like a dual power of actual human beings rather than the monstrosity that we live around us. It just, for me, feels like an assertion, much more than an actual solution in the way in which they're couching it, like it's a solution. But for me, it feels much more like an assertion.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those bits where it's difficult to find anything with which I disagree, but partially because it's difficult to say that there's a clear claim. And so to say we're going to win this by living communism, I mean, I would say, of course, living anarchism, because that's a term I'm more comfortable with for various reasons, but if someone says I want to live anarchism, I mean, sure, it's difficult to disagree, but I guess I don't know what that looks like, or I don't know what it looks like for other people. I don't know what it looks like for a stranger who's writing something, inviting me and others to take part in that.
Well, but again, you because we do know enough about the work of the Apolistas, we know what they're referring to here, which is, in the context of France, the Apolistas have removed themselves from the counterculture of punk rock / anarchism, and definitely from the leftism of syndicalism, and have mostly built their own sandbox. And so this looks like cafes, this looks like restaurants, this looks like a big chunk of land in middle south of France. Mm-hmm. And so
really it's the full dual power program.
It is the dual power program. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they totally reject sort of the maybe some of the logic that like when we refer to dual power in the North American context, we're referring to building all the things that the civilization already does, but and doing it so much better that somehow these new institutions, set themselves on replacing the institutions that currently exist. Normally that has looked for, like, very bleak, and at least in my very brief time in France, theirs felt much less bleak. So that's what they're talking about, at least from their own perspective. But it sounds so beautiful. I mean, I love that paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is the sort of aspirational attitude I would love to be able to take more.
Well, and to me, it very much resonates with your line of human scale, right?
Sure.
That you're talking about yourself, certain relationships that you have. You're talking about things you can see and touch and interact with, not a kind of grand vision of a world that you never experience as a whole.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, now we wanted to spend some time responding to the thoughtful email that I mentioned before.
If you're squeezed for information, that's when you got to play it dumb. You just sail out there waiting for the miracle. For the miracle to come.
So I'm going to read parts of this, not the entire thing, because it was a bit long. And in particular, I was going to largely skip over the beginning of the email where this writer criticized me for positing these natural human needs as if they were essential to the organism when I was talking about the motivations that one has toward believing in revolution in our last episode on revolution. And they accused me of being Freudian. And
actually, before you jump ahead, I do want to say that they accuse us of having these making these human nature arguments,
right?
And I sort of have a pithy response to almost any times someone makes human nature arguments that it says more about them than it does about human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little strange that I'm not, you know, because I'm not exactly sure where they were getting at with accusing us of having this value system. Speaking more.
Yeah, and I was just going to say I thought that those desires that I was referring to were ones that at least were common in this contemporary culture. And I was trying to frame it in terms of things like depression and human phenomena that I have felt or experienced in other people directly in my life. And so I wasn't trying to say it was something that was intrinsic to the human in all places and times. But their main point was about what they perceived as the emptiness of our praxis. And so I'll quote parts of it here. If I understand it correctly, praxis proposed by both Bellamy and Aragorn as an alternative to participation in the revolutionary project basically boiled down to this: face-to-face activity with like-minded people in a shared space where their shared values attain a degree of self-evident hegemony. And so then this person goes on to say, why are we even calling ourselves anarchists? And they say, if, as opposed to the need for overthrowing the established order through participation in a historical movement that could only accomplish this purpose over time, it is deemed possible for one to secede, dissociate, withdraw from the institutions and bonds of the established order in an immediate way, and then later they say, why not adopt the model of organization that has historically proved successful in achieving such ends? Why not make a clean breast of it and unburden oneself of the ideological baggage attached to the label anarchist, which automatically tends to encourage people to think, relate, and act in terms of political struggle? And so they talk about how there have been all these secessionist movements throughout time and reference a book by Kenneth Rexroth on this topic, and then say, but look at the fact that all of these efforts of secession or intentional community have failed. And they say, maybe this has something to do with the thesis, central to the revolutionary perspective, that attempts to withdraw from the misery of an existence divorced from history are illusory and doomed to fail. You speak of revolution in terms of a Christian injunction to defer gratification to an imagined future, whereas I would say this is far more applicable to the bourgeois idea of happiness, which promises an imagined gratification in the present. And then they go on to trash the post-left idea of anarchy as the pursuit of unmediated joy and say that it's just a post-left version of this bourgeois idea. And then basically go on to say that happiness in an unhappy world is impossible, and talk about how it's actually revolutionary theory is what has actually holds potential to free the human being, not just giving them this sort of shallow, what they perceive as a shallow immediate happiness that's personal or shared among a small group, and that in fact what we need is to overturn the whole thing and stop the existence of the unhappy world.
Yeah. I mean, that's at the heart of their argument. I guess I'll start by just talking about the misunderstanding. I felt like when we were talking about sort of what we would argue people should spend their energy on in the here and now, the context of that is a little bigger than like, because we don't believe in that revolution is possible, therefore we should just grow gardens and hang out with our friends. About half of what they had to say really resonated with me. Apologies for the
dog
fights.
Dog activity.
Yeah. Although there appears to be some chittering animal.
It's all kinds of sounds today.
Yeah, it's as if Berkeley were like a nature refuge or something. But I guess, to put it bluntly, especially in hearing you say it out loud, they're making the religious argument. Like, they have an assertion that the total transformation that a revolution would entail is the exegesis of it is their motivation, and so that's fine. I definitely am not The point to me is I guess to be blunt about that. Like okay, you have a passionate feeling that if a revolution were to happen, then life would be worth living, and I kind of agree with you. Like, it would be really neat. But, and that but to me is sort of the problem of like the second and third decade of my radical life. The story of the first decade of my life was exactly the same thing. How do we make it happen? Well, most of the tools that we have contemplated and that radicals have come up with that would lead one that point in the direction of what do? Are really bad. Like, we have not matured in any. Yeah, they're just really bad tools.
Yeah, I did read this also as a kind of doubling down of saying, I think the email was well written and thoughtful, but I also think it was reducible in some ways to just saying, hey, I think what you're saying about revolution is not true, and that in fact it is possible, and that when it does come, we will be liberated, and in the meantime, the kinds of stuff you're talking about, I think, sucks. And they actually frame it in terms of a question of strategy, which I found interesting, because I don't really frame things in these terms. They said, I have a question about your strategy. And strategy, to me, would seem to imply a grand scale, many people, whereas, as we've talked about in the show many times, I tend to restrict my thinking to a very personal sphere, myself, my relationships, what I can do in my immediate environment. And I might speculate about what's happening on the grand scale. I speculate about things like what's going to happen in the wake of the Paris massacres. But ultimately, I'm just getting that kind of information through these dubious sources, and I don't know what's going on the other side of the world. And so to even frame things beyond just a projectual life, to me, doesn't feel like what my anarchism is.
Right, that was the other thing, is that they did just seem to be responding to, like, one episode rather than an aggregate of comments. But to state what you've said from my own perspective in terms of my own action, I don't think about myself all that much at all. In other words, the personal pleasure is absolutely not my motivation for the activity that I do. And by and large, the reason that I am involved in publishing and the reason that I'm so aggressive about being involved in publishing is because I would like the broader conversation that we're having within the context of the anarchist space to be different than it has been before.
Sure.
In other words, to put it in terms that I would never put it in, I'm still absolutely fascinated with the questions of revolution. Mm-hmm. I just think that the way to have them is different than the ways in which I sort of was educated to have them in the past. So as an example, you know, a deeper reading of Marx or a deeper reading of the SI or a deeper reading of any European thinker, for me, is not the way to think about what a revolutionary, by which I mean total transformation of society, would look like. I'm much more interested at this point in my life to going to sources that look more North American. And so, as we've talked about in the past, that looks like, what does an indigenous perspective on this question look like? And to me, the answer that I'm grappling with right now is, it looks like telling better stories. And that might seem like such a small thing and so unsophisticated compared to, you know, the incredible revolutionary thinkers that I have around me, but it feels like something that I am capable of doing in my life and of sharing and of enjoying the process the entire way. And so for me, that brings in SI thinking, this, you know, because I do think a lot about the project of revolution being the most exciting and the most interesting thing that someone can do. But that the process of thinking about revolution has become totally perverted by a set of values that confuses politique, or real politique, with politics, and that basically puts us in this sort of shallow pool of standing in front of City Hall, when if we look at the last 100 years of sort of transformation of the world, and look at a hierarchy of what has actually changed the world, information technologies have changed the world arguably as much as the working class. And I'm not sort of doubling down on that statement, but for me that the systems way of thinking about these problems to me feels much more like the way that I'd like to think about these problems than just thinking about how can we hit City Hall harder next time.
Yeah, and I think you touched on something there I want to tease out a bit more, which is just what, when radicals talk about changing the world, what does that really mean? I would say often it's a very discrete understanding of change. Either it's the total change of the world through revolution, or it's staying the same and we're under domination, and that any kind of idea of partial change or incremental change is necessarily a conversation about reform, which I don't think is true. And so when you talk about doing things like a publishing project, I mean, you've been involved in media for many years. I've been involved in media for a couple of years. And the idea that because we talk pessimistically about revolution, that we're consigned to living under domination and nothing changing at all, I think is really a false accusation. That if you have a metaphysic of the world as becoming, as a world that is constantly changing, then transformation is happening all the time. And the question is, where do I want to give it a little push here, a little push there, with this little human body that I have, and try to push it more in the right direction? I mean, a serious media effort is, one hopes, changing conversations, changing perspectives, changing actions. And I don't mean that I don't think that kind of perspective is consigned to a sort of boring, bland liberalism, even though I think it's likely to be sneered at that way. But I think that is, just as I've talked about with pessimism, a way of mistaking attitude for the action that might follow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is always something that I've, at least the last 10 years, I've felt very strongly that it's, that anarchism by assertion, I have no more interest in this. And I say this coming out of the post-left perspective, where the assertions are always sort of hostile and pointing at like ancient anarchist practice. And so over time, I found that the idea of pointing your finger and saying that is bad, I mean, it's something that I will do when sitting around with friends, but in my projects, I just don't find it as interesting as I did a long time ago. What I find to be more interesting is what is the work on the ground that one is doing as an expression of their anarchist value system or of their beliefs. And so, you know, I find the expression of why people are involved in a squad or why people have done an occupation or why people are doing their publishing project to be, that's for me the compelling stuff. That's the sinew that I like to work in, rather than what words we use and how, yeah, which words are the correct words to use to describe. I recall one of the criticisms that I received after I wrote the Towards an Indigenous Anarchism.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got a response from a serious insurrectionary anarchist type person who basically said, do you understand, or, you know, I'd like to inform you that anarchism is the ideology of, you know, an old 150-year-old philosophical view, and anarchy is the real thing that you know, you should desire, and that by adding the ism, you basically totally ruined the essay.
Wow.
And, it you know, it really sort of got me thinking a lot about, like, what's the effort? Like, you know, are we really going to argue about anarchy versus anarchism as the correct way to describe the good? Like, fuck that. That's a waste of my time. And so this is both the reason and not the reason why I still use the word anarchism to refer to that part of the criticism.
I was just going to follow up by saying, you know, okay. You don't feel that it necessarily ties you to that historical tendency.
I don't.
That'd be a response.
Mm-hmm. But that's because I've lived in it for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you talk to a stranger and you say the word, and I have done this on a couple different occasions where I've gone into a room cold and used the word,
mm-hmm.
the responses you get aren't about the ancient history.
Right.
You can, I mean, the responses you get are still about bomb throwing.
Right.
And terrorism.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I certainly have some sensitivities to this sort of, I have an allergy to a label thing, but anarchist is definitely one of the ones I feel more comfortable with. And, I mean, I think all you have to do is look at what the word means. I mean, I long for a world without, and I try my best to live toward one without archos or archons, right? Without domination. And I think that can mean, of course, state and capital. It can mean, of course, these internalized person-on-person oppressions, or it can mean domination of the way that you're thinking. And I don't think that I'm necessarily, or I don't agree with this idea that, well, if you're not for revolution, then get out of the club.
Yeah, and you know, again, as someone who sort of poo-poos the term revolution in general, in the, you know, as informed by Nikon, but also as informed by what I see when I meet people who use that sort of terminology, is what I am responding to by and large is not some abstract term revolution that I may or may not be for, but what I'm reacting to is my lived experience of how I see it used by people, mostly as a nonsense term. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah. So there were two more parts here I think we should touch on.
Okay.
This email writer notes that attempts at withdrawal have failed, so why keep doing them? I found this interesting because, you know, arguably we've never been rid of domination since it popped up, at least in the last 11,700 years. So, I mean, it just seems like an argument for a kind of deep passive pessimism in general. And, I mean, the manifestations that revolution has had has been, of course, just new iterations of domination, ones that are different.
Sorry, but their accusation was that we were withdrawing. They're pointing at us as being the withdrawers.
Right. No, I know, but I'm saying that I'm saying arguably all efforts at trying to overthrow, resist, withdraw from, evade, I mean, you could say in an ultimate sense, they fail because no one has ever been able to permanently relieve themselves from the effects of domination in the world, even if they're distant, and arguably no one has ever succeeded in overthrowing it in its entirety. And so,
but that's what they're accusing us of.
But I'm saying that if they're saying the problem is that these attempts don't work, I would say arguably all attempts have not worked. So it seems
sure,
like an argument
sure.
for just completely giving up on radicalism in general.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I think it depends on one's metric, of course, because I'm not giving them the completely fair answer. Like, I think of some historical withdrawal efforts that arguably have had their own sort of measure of success. I think of the ones that Seaweed talked about in his book Land and Freedom, the ones Sikalski talked about in Gone to Croatan, and I'm not saying that these are the end-all, be-all perfect things, but I'm saying depending on your metric, there have been measures of success. In the same vein as depending on your metric, certain media projects, if they change conversations, have had some measure of success. You know,
yeah,
depends on what your metric is, and I think I agree with the metric that's not a total deep passive pessimism, so if your emphasis changes from the total changing of the world in its entirety to something a little bit more humble, then there have been successes.
Yeah. I mean, arguably, counterculture is an attempt to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. You know, there's just no other way to describe it. We had a goth person in the house recently, and I was really struck by how, like, wow, I don't understand what they're excited about. They were talking about a diesel-powered hearse being like a goal for them, and I was like, wow, I don't get it, but okay, that's kind of cool. You're committed. but I actually want to take a bit more offense to this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really don't understand who, like, I'm not sharing a podcast of opinions as just a person with opinions. I mean, to accuse someone involved in Little Black Heart as being a withdrawer, mm-hmm. I don't understand it. So there's a part there where, okay, I'm gonna restate what I just said as softly as I can. One of the reasons why I use the term anarchist and continue to is so that I have some way in which I can have a relationship with somebody that doesn't begin with what our emphasis is. So, for instance, if you say that you're an anti-civilization anarchist, is the first thing that you say to a new person who is perhaps also an anarchist, you've framed the relationship in a way that, that like you're going to have to talk about what your emphasis is. And one of the things I like to say about the hyphen between anarcho-communist and green anarchist, and that hyphen oftentimes speaks to what the emphasis is of the person you're talking to, and sometimes that hyphen is about what they're really into rather than anarchism. So this is why ultimately I've landed on that I describe myself as an anarchist, full stop. Obviously I have some emphasis, but in a conversation with a new person, I want to start with anarchism. So why that's relevant is because they started this conversation, and a lot of people who give us feedback, they're starting the conversation not sort of in the grounded sense of, like, we share this thing, or it doesn't feel like it's starting with, like, let's talk about what our different emphases are. Instead, it sort of feels like an argument about truth. And so in their case, they're arguing that revolution is truth, and that it's the thing that could win. And because I ultimately don't have an answer to that particular debate point or that way of seeing the world, I don't think that there's a particular answer that's going to lead us to anywhere. That's a very frustrating thing for people who do, especially people who are used to debating these topics. And it reminds me actually of when you tell someone that you don't drink alcohol. Immediately you have 3-4 conversations about how weird it is for them. Like, they basically fetishize your lack as being something that's extremely important, as if it's something that's central to who it is that you are and how you walk in the world. And so similar when we're talking about political perspectives, this idea of starting their conversation out with all this sort of embedded logics that may or may not be true, for me, this is ultimately what I found very frustrating with, you know. Mm-hmm. And this person in particular has that whiff of situationist denouncement to them, which we could talk about at length another time, but basically, like, it's a classic way to, like, begin sort of like a very doodly type of relationship with somebody with, like, you're so fucked up. Respond.
Mm-hmm. It's a conversation stopper rather than a stopper.
Absolutely, yeah. But because it's so exciting in the context of the SI, a lot of people do it. Mm-hmm.
And then the last bit I wanted to respond to was the bit about unmediated joy, and they quoted Wallace Stevens saying, "A happy people in an unhappy world, it cannot be." And I certainly agree that our capacity for happiness or joy is diminished in this world. It reminds me of what the podcast The Haters, the people behind that, were trying to say that I sort of responded to, maybe in a way that confused them. But I'm totally not convinced of this idea that unmediated joy, in the way that it's talked about in a lot of post-left discourse, is the same thing as bourgeois immediate gratification. As this person says, to me, joy and happiness are just simply not synonyms. When I think of joy, I think of presence, of connection, of ego death, of a kind of lack of alienation. And whereas to me, bourgeois gratification is narcissism, is comfort, is avarice, acquisition, and I just don't see these things as synonymous at all, so I just found that full stop ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm perhaps more sympathetic to the position, just because ultimately I have the same critique of the individual people that I know's behavior and how it coordinates to the things that they have written. Mm-hmm. But
this is what we call tu quoque. It's the rhetorical fallacy in which you say your position is wrong because you do not live up to it.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at there. I'm not trying to accuse anyone of anything other than the fact that my orientation ultimately has... I mean, it ends up being sort of like as you get to know yourself. Like, when we are young, we all sort of aspire to being everything and to being, joyful and passions and desires, right? Uh-huh. But for me, the epicness of my vision has had a lot more to do with something different, maybe something social, maybe something small. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is totally related to the fact, I mean, the example I used earlier, the fact that I don't drink and that I'm not jolly in the way that that otherwise I would seem to be, because I'm a big personality and I make jokes and blah, 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 blah. But because I don't drink, it means that the joke ends halfway through what most people experience as a full social experience. Mm-hmm. And so I've dealt with this a lot in my life where, where joy is inebriation. And I don't just mean it in the context of drinking alcohol, but that joy is something sort of sloppy and messy and again, to be blunt, bro-like. And I don't know what else to say about that other than the fact that like ultimately the reason that I continue to do all the media projects that I do is that I really enjoy the work and I enjoy seeing the impact of the work on the world. But I wouldn't recommend it to other people. And anyways, this is a topic we can talk about in other episodes.
That would be a good topic. Yeah.
Well, because it basically it's not about alcohol, it's about this the difference between like what you would recommend for others versus what you do yourself, and the fact that there's a gap there.
There definitely is for me as well. I'm noticing we're winding down, and I wondered if you wanted to put a quick announcement about Black Sea 4, because someone asked that we...
Yeah, I should consider, maybe we'll chop this up and put this at the front of the episode, but my strong hope is that Black Seed 4 is going to be ready by the East Bay Anarchist Book Fair, which is December 5th, or two weekends from now, we're just having some technical holdups involving the layout process, and...
meaning that everything's written and ready to go.
Everything's ready to go. We're just waiting on the designer to return some some PDFs. So hopefully it'll be ready in 2 weeks. Definitely it'll be ready in December. And I look forward to seeing what people think about it. I guess this is the end of episode 13 of the Brilliant Podcast. Thanks.
And just to give a little teaser, the next two episodes we're going to be talking about ideas like bioregionalism and anarchists' relationships with land, and is this something that's worth pursuing, or is it a sort of dead-end praxis?
Not my questions, but excellent.